This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, and I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here on this fine Sunday afternoon to be the managing partner of your life. And I'm here alone. I'm not with my wonderful, beautiful colleague who is on assignment. Carrie Kasem isn't here. Not sure where she is. My producer, Genevieve Wong, just told me she wouldn't be here. I think she's out smoking some drugs or something, but she's not here. Not where she should be. And, of course, Carrie doesn't do that. So I'm just saying that because I am teasing the show. I don't have Carrie to tease me, so I have to tease the show. We are talking about cannabis today. First time in almost 7 years that we've been on the air, we're doing a dope show. It's dope. And I'll tell you, we've got some great guests to enlighten us on the issues relating to cannabis and the law and even investing in cannabis. Later in the show, we have the cannabis king from Fast Money, CNBC's Fast Money, Tim Seymour, known as the cannabis king, will talk about the stocks involved with cannabis and what you should or should not be doing in your investing. If you get into this kind of investment, it's a little bit risky, as everyone must know, because of the current situation, at least in this country, with respect to the legalities on the federal level of cannabis versus some of the states that have had successful initiatives that have created the legal aspects of cannabis. But of course, there's a conflict. And our first guest can address that because he is an expert in his own right. Sam Reisman is the cannabis reporter on Law 360. He's a writer and an editor. He's based in New York. He's a senior reporter. He's done a lot of investigative reporting, and he's got this real creative side to him on his podcasts and some of the other managing and editor jobs that he's doing, like at the National Memo. Sam Reisman, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Hi, thanks for having me. Thanks for that warm intro.
Oh, of course. It's really warm out here. I don't know how it is in New York, but I got it.
Getting colder.
It's getting colder. Well, you still have a little bit of time. We're in a heat wave and will continue to be so at least for another month. And, you feel like you're just smoking here. It's so hot. Speaking of smoking, let's talk first of all. Exactly. I don't have Carrie Kasem here to laugh at my joke, so I need you to go for it. Let's talk about Law 360. We have a lot of lawyers who listen to the show, but a lot of non-lawyers as well. Talk about 360. Tell us what you do. Every morning I get my email on Law 360, some of the best articles and writings that you'll see in the law. Tell us about your involvement and what Law 360 is.
Sure. Law 360 is a trade publication for lawyers and other professionals. We report on a variety of different practice areas and industries with an eye towards bringing lawyers the news that they need to, you know, stand out in their practice. For the previous 2 years that I've been with the company, I covered the business of law, that is to say, sort of the law firms themselves. But we're switching gears because one of our newest launches is going to be this cannabis section, because this has increasingly become something that's impossible to ignore for lawyers and for law firms, as it's grown as a state legal business in this country. And there's this increasing need for lawyers in the space, and lawyers want to understand what the major issues are. So that's where I come in. That's where Law 360 and my colleagues come in. And that's why, as you noted, I'm the senior reporter for cannabis for Law 360, because this is an area of law that is evolving very quickly and really needs a lot of eyes on it.
So, Sam, you state that it's impossible to ignore. A lot of people will say, well, I'd like to ignore it. I don't want to get involved. I don't want to deal with it. I'm going to respect the federal law as it is, even though it may be quickly changing or maybe not so quickly changing. Tell us why it's impossible for a lawyer to ignore, and what are the issues that a lawyer should be involved with cannabis?
I guess I should be clear. A lawyer is free to ignore it, but as a news agency that covers the legal industry, you know, it became hard for us to ignore it because more and more of the major players in the industry, the so-called AmLaw 200, are beginning to launch cannabis practices. The largest law firm in the world by headcount has a cannabis practice. Increasingly, it's no longer the province of just these niche firms that are localized in states like Colorado or California, where it's sort of been an industry for a while. It is increasingly becoming something that law firms with a national platform really want to bring their skills and their personnel to the table and really compete in this space. So certainly a lawyer can go on being, you know, any kind of lawyer that they want to be and not step a toe in this industry. But I think for some law firms or some individual attorneys that are maybe feeling a little bit more entrepreneurial, there's certainly a lot of opportunity there.
Okay, so talk a little bit about those lawyers who are involved, or those large law firms, small law firms, medium-sized law firms, forming a cannabis department or having a couple of attorneys focusing on the cannabis practice. What are the issues that a cannabis lawyer is looking at in 2019 going into 2020? Because again, we can't look into the future. We don't know what things are going to be like in 2025 or 30. But right now, with the current state of the laws, and I emphasize laws, what are the issues that cannabis lawyers focus on?
The answer briefly is just about everything that any other business focuses on. It just becomes a lot more complicated when you add the regulatory overlay of being a cannabis company onto that. So if you are a real estate attorney negotiating leases for your clients to build, you know, warehouses where they can grow the product, if you're an IP attorney securing the trademarks for your clients' cannabis products, or securing and making sure that their marks aren't being stolen by rival cannabis companies, that's a major problem. Mm-hmm. If you're an agriculture attorney, securing permits for grow fields, the list goes on and on. A joke or a sort of observation, maybe a quip that I've heard from multiple lawyers in this space, is that when their clients were getting into the marijuana business, they didn't know that they were really getting into the compliance business.
Right.
And that's something that you hear a lot. Another thing that I heard an in-house counsel at a Colorado-based cannabis company once said is, it's like the big stone that you throw into a pond of legal issues, and it just ripples outward and it touches everything. So I can go into a little bit more detail, but the brief answer is just about everything you can think of that a business lawyer, you know, may have developed a skill set in, they can probably bring that to bear in the cannabis field. It's just that it's going to be a lot more complicated because there's just this, as I said, this regulatory overlay,
right,
that also is changing constantly and varies state by state.
And we want to talk about that in a few minutes. But first of all, I want to focus on what the prevailing companies that you're seeing now and that lawyers are involved with are doing with respect to balancing the legal, business, and ethical issues that are replete in a cannabis-type business. Because, of course, as you mentioned, we have the federal law that doesn't support this kind of business. And there are all kinds of issues, such as, for instance, credit card companies and how they deal with cannabis purchases and marketing. And then there are other issues that may be legal on a state basis, but not federally. So how big a problem is it, and what kind of risks are these companies taking, not knowing specifically what the future is like and what regulations will be in place?
I think it's precisely because cannabis companies do want to color within the lines now that they are increasingly retaining lawyers. And lawyers, for their part, as you mentioned, yes, are bound by ethical strictures in whatever state that they're licensed to practice in. As I'm sure your listeners know, the model rules of the American Bar Association pretty specifically prescribe that a lawyer shall not counsel a client to engage in conduct that they know to be criminal. And there's that kind of, there's that tension there, isn't there, if you're representing a client whose business is federally illegal. Luckily, what's happened for, luckily for the lawyers, I should say, what's happened in the last couple of years is different state bars have created carve-outs saying that as long as basically the first thing you do is advise your client, this is illegal federally, but then proceed to counsel them to the fullest extent of your ability to stay within those state regulations, to abide by those state laws. It is, you know, you're not at risk for censure or even criminal proceedings yourself. So that's been the biggest development from sort of the legal ethics side over the last few years, as states have continued to legalize marijuana and hemp, that they have, that the state bar agencies that regulate the attorneys have also created a little bit more latitude for lawyers to serve as clients.
Right. We have to take a break. After the break, I want to talk about the crystal ball and what we see in the future. I know it's hard for you, but you have this expertise being the cannabis reporter on Law 360. It's Sam Reisman, and you're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, the intersection of law and life, that would be cannabis and litigation. Actually, it's a lot more than just cannabis and litigation. We're talking to Sam Reisman, who is the cannabis reporter on Law 360. He's a senior reporter for Law 360, has a lot of information, has done a lot of work on the cannabis revolution. And Sam, I want to ask you, I mentioned litigation, and there seems to be so much of it going on, especially in Canada as well, with the Canadian cannabis companies. Of course, cannabis is legal federally and provincially, so they don't have the conflict in laws as we do here in this country. But talk a little bit about the litigation and how the companies have positioned themselves in that regard.
Sure. It's happening on a couple of fronts. What's happened this year, specifically since the passage of the 2018 Farm Bill that sort of broadly legalized hemp at the federal level, is you're still seeing these lawsuits brought by hemp companies against states that still consider the crop contraband. There was a case this year where a trucker was on his way from Oregon, where it is legal, to Colorado, where it is legal, with 13,000 pounds of hemp. And he was arrested in Idaho, which is one of the very few states that has not legalized marijuana or hemp at any level, not even for medicinal use. The cargo was impounded and he was arrested, and he faces felony trafficking charges. And the company recently brought their action to try to get some of that hemp back all the way to the Ninth Circuit, where it's pending. That's just one example. There's another lawsuit pending
Didn't he say that he mistook the map and should have gone through Nevada or something and avoided Idaho?
The circuit court judge at the end of oral arguments made a quip about how they should have gone through Nevada, and the attorney representing the hemp company said, in retrospect, Your Honor, we should have gone through Nevada. So that's a lesson hard learned, I would say. And there's a similar case going on about the hemp regulations in Indiana, because they've passed recently a local state law that specifically has provisions against smokable hemp. So there's all kinds of little things like that where I'd say the devil's in the details, that even though hemp has been legalized at the federal level, you're still running into these cases where companies are running up against state laws that are maybe more strict, and state authorities that haven't, you know, switched gears from treating the crop as they have for the last several decades as a hard drug, as contraband. So those are some of the litigations you're seeing at the federal court level. And, you know, I would add that these were companies that, you know, did not exist in, you know, with the protections of law a few years ago. Now they are increasingly feeling comfortable bringing each other to court in order to secure their trademarks. So you're seeing a lot of intellectual property work as well, and a lot of IP litigation in this space as well. So that's something new that is going to be very interesting to see unfold.
And it's no small matter when you look at the value, or at least the valuations of some of these companies. There's been so much money put into cannabis, obviously because of the idea that it's going to take off and it's going to be like Coca-Cola in the future. So when you talk about the litigation and all of the regulations, how are these companies surviving with their sales? Because a lot of them aren't profitable yet. Are there just so many investors that are trying to make a buck and that they've created, or perhaps artificially, these great, huge values in these companies where litigation is really just one of the consequences of having this kind of company?
I can't speak too much to the profitability of these companies. I don't really cover that end of things. I will say that the M&A space in cannabis is extremely active. These companies are buying each other up left and right. And one M&A attorney who works in the space told me that something that can complicate those transactions a little bit is when you go to sort of the origins of these companies, the sort of founding agreements, a lot of it was handshake deals. As you can imagine, circa 2014, 2013, people weren't really willing to put their names on paper in connection with a cannabis company. So some of the downstream effects of that is as the industry matures, I imagine there will be some derivative litigation from these companies as they gobble each other up and become acquired.
Now,
I can't really speak to the sort of financial side of things.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of them aren't as clear as you would hope because of the nature of the business, and it probably isn't as public as a lot of companies are. Speaking of which, when you talk about the IRS and Section 280E forbids cannabis companies from deducting business expenses, how does that impact the businesses?
It impacts it hugely. If you talk to a lot of cannabis lawyers, they'll tell you this is one of their biggest banes, is this provision of the federal tax code that says that a business can't deduct expenses in connection with trafficking a federally illegal drug. What that does in effect is even if you are a state legal marijuana company and everything you do is completely above board at the state level, you still have a tax liability that's much, much higher than any other comparable company your size, because you have this federal tax provision that just says that your business expenses can't be deducted. So that's been one of the major places where these companies have been sort of pushing back and trying to lobby for a change at the federal level. They're less interested in descheduling or decriminalizing marijuana than just getting this 280E thing off their back. Even the medical companies, which have far less, to fear from prosecutors, this is still one of their biggest priorities.
So why isn't there prosecution? Because it's funny listening to you talking about IRS federal tax system and the illegality, criminal law, federal code. And here we have regulations, so to speak, using the term not literally, for companies deducting business expenses that deal in cannabis. Why aren't they shut down? And why are they getting the ability to do business even if they can't have the deductions that other companies have?
To answer your question why they aren't being prosecuted, there was a memorandum issued by then Deputy Attorney General James Cole, which sort of set the tune, where he said that the Department of Justice would not go after cannabis companies that were state legal, provided they weren't doing anything very illegal, like selling to minors or engaged in other forms of organized crime. That kind of created enough breathing room that lawyers and other service providers felt comfortable doing business with cannabis companies, secure in the knowledge that the feds wouldn't be kicking down their door. Jeff Sessions rescinded the Cole memo in 2018, but even since then, the Department of Justice has shown very little appetite for really prosecuting these companies. Even more so than the Cole memo, what has really shielded a lot of the companies working in this space from prosecution is an appropriations bill that keeps getting extended every year that basically says the Department of Justice is not allowed to spend any money going after medical companies. Now, that hasn't extended to the recreational companies, but even still, the U.S. Attorney's offices have shown very little appetite for going after these companies as long as they are abiding by state laws.
So that's a good point, and I'm glad you brought it up because you differentiate between medical purposes and recreational purposes. Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of attention and money put it in, especially from the federal government, in trying to differentiate between the objectives of these companies?
That's a good question, and I don't know. The FDA is currently looking into applications of CBD derived from hemp, which is something that they weren't doing a few years ago. So I think that you're beginning to see maybe some very incremental movement in that direction of recognizing the value of cannabis as a medical product at the federal level. But generally, I think just from what I've observed, there hasn't been too much policy, differentiating at the federal level, between medical and recreational.
How much focus is Law 360, organization that you're senior reporter, cannabis reporter for, how much emphasis are they putting on their stories as we move forward? Because something has to break in the next several months and years. Are they trying to get ahead of the game as well?
I think we're certainly trying to differentiate ourselves as far as there are a lot of eyes on this space right now. But people are covering it for readers who might be investors, certainly readers who might be consumers. I think we're really trying to carve out a niche for ourselves for the increasing number of lawyers that are servicing clients in the space. And that goes for clients that both, quote unquote, touch the plant, that is to say the growers and distributors, and those who don't. There's this whole sort of secondary industry that services cannabis companies in terms of manufacturing devices, right, and processes for extracting the chemical. So things like that.
So if you had a crystal ball, what would you say is the future in this country, in the United States, for cannabis and the companies that deal in the various forms of marketing cannabis?
I think you're going to have to see some kind of guidance coming down at the federal level. I don't know whether that's going to be a circuit court ruling. I don't know whether that's going to be there's a couple of bills making their way through Congress right now. But I think you're correct. Something has to break at the federal level where there's going to be some uniformity applied to the industry across state lines, and to give people, like that trucker who got arrested in Idaho, the security of knowing that this crop that is legal in one state and legal in another will also be legal along the way. And I think that's going to be very interesting. How that federal uniformity comes about, and how long it's going to take, and what form it will take.
So are you saying then, folks that invest in companies that dealing with cannabis are making a good investment because it's inevitable that the feds are going to change policy and law?
I am absolutely not qualified to give investment advice, but I can comfortably say that for lawyers who are interested in this space, there's going to be a lot of work moving forward.
Nice answer. And by the way, that's a great tease for our next guest, Tim Seymour, who is qualified as the chief investment officer for Seymour Asset Management, a strategist on CNBC and on Fast Money. He can give advice. So after the break, we're going to talk to Tim Seymour to hear some of his advice on cannabis. He is the cannabis king in the investment world. Sam Reisman from Law 360, thanks so much for being with us today on Gervie's Law.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Tim Seymour after this. Look in the eye. Yeah, I think I'm just going to listen to the music for the next half hour. Smoke a joint and listening to the music. Well, Carrie Kasem isn't here, so if you're calling to talk to her, You're out of luck. She's on assignment. I have no idea what the assignment is, but she is not here. One of the first times in the last 7 years, she just disappeared. Not sure if she's not into this subject. First time that we've talked about cannabis in 7 years here on Gervie's Law. And we're learning a lot. And of course, it always begs the question, when you talk about cannabis, you talk about, is it an investment opportunity? And I think our next guest is well qualified to give us that answer. He is the Chief Investment Officer of Seymour Asset Management. He's a strategist on CNBC and, of course, well-known analyst on Fast Money, the CNBC program. He's known as the Cannabis King. I think I can call him that. Tim Seymour, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Hey, Alan. How are you? Great to be here. Pleasure to be here.
I am doing great, and it's really great to have you on the show. Tim, when we talk about the Cannabis King, that name doesn't come lightly. How do you acquire
a moniker.
Name?
Those are some deep shoes to fill, or some, you know, a deep bowl to pack.
I always thought it was Cheech Marin or someone like that, but it's Tim Seymour. Tell us how you got that name.
I'll tell you what, I think Cheech Marin, Tommy Chong, and a bunch of other folks actually who have, believe it or not, been thought leaders in the space are should be considered kind of forefathers. But I think the investment angle here is one that, for me, I approach this as an investor who has spent a lot of his career investing in new asset classes, emerging markets. I lived in Russia at one point. I invested in Brazil. I invested in China. I invested in other things that also just on an asset
class. What about Bitcoin, Tim? What about Bitcoin?
We've done a number of Bitcoin shows. You have.
I'm sure your audience is certainly looking at
a lot of the investment trends, and I think there's probably a fair amount of anxiety around them as well.
Right.
What I would say is, as someone who, first of all, has invested in far-flung, higher-risky, new asset classes, the investment thesis behind investing in cannabis is something that I think you can approach from two or three different areas, and they all sound pretty exciting, at least from a top-down basis. Remember, again, why are we talking about this is because there's been a legislative movement across our country to legalize both the medical cannabis and the adult cannabis markets. And it's because the public has voted with their feet, and therefore politicians are more concerned with votes probably than truly necessarily if they've all changed their view or not. But the bottom line is there's a legislative process taking place, not just in this country, but around the world. Your viewers are aware that Canada legalized the full adult market in October of last year. So as these dominoes continue to fall, the investment approach is one that says there's kind of a macro trade. And without getting too wonky into kind of macroeconomics from back when, there are catalysts for this sector and for investment in cannabis that are going to be purely driven by macro events like the next legislative moment. And in cannabis in the United States, the next legislative moment is probably going to be what is called the SAFE Act, which is something that's going to allow companies to get proper access to banking and properly be able to report revenues in a traditional accounting format that would allow them to actually potentially be profitable. But at a time that we are in this country still getting comfortable with all of the concepts and all the legislation around cannabis, it's still illegal for traditional federally sponsored banks to bank the sector. So without getting too lost into the legislative framework, there have been a series of macro events that have been driving people into the sector probably for 5 years. I think the most important theme to talk about tonight or today is that this is a consumer product that is on some level no different than any other consumer product that is consumed and marketed and distributed and in a very sophisticated way presented to consumers around this country.
But now, Tim, it may be different than a lot of consumer products as you speak about it. You know, I just got back. I was in Canada for 3 weeks. We summer up in Lake Muskoka. And I talked to a number of people about cannabis and about stocks. And, you know, they talk about CanTrust. That's a favorite topic. They talk about Canopy and Aurora and Aphria and Namaste. And they all say the same things. They're looking to the United States and they're saying these stock valuations don't make sense. So when you look at profitability, which you're talking about, and most of them have none, how do these valuations make any sense to get into the sector now?
Well, it's you know, the point is well taken. If you look at valuations in Canada and the U.S., it's very difficult to justify where they're trading on traditional valuation metrics. And for those that are looking at stocks every day, for example, on a EV to EBITDA basis, you're looking at probably trading anywhere from 10 to 35 times in Canada. And in the U.S., I'd just say as a marketplace, they're probably trading about half the multiple that the Canadian LPs are trading on an EV EBITDA. On a price to sales or an EV to sales, so enterprise value to sales, and it should be noted that because of the banking dynamics, I'd say that most of the companies in the cannabis sector, whether they're in Canada actually or in the United States, don't have a lot of debt on their balance sheet. So when people talk about a bubble bursting and whatnot, I think they have to be careful. This isn't the same as other asset classes that were levered up on debt. But anyway, getting back to the valuations, if you look at where cannabis companies are trading on an EV to sales, they're trading at about 11 times in Canada. They're trading at about 5 times in the U.S., and that's on 2020 expected multiples. One of the great problems for the sector, I think, is a function of where it has come from. So this constraint of capital, this legal dynamic, which has made investing in the sector more challenging than traditional sectors, has led to this bubble-like proportion. It's also led, frankly, to something that I think the companies could have done a much better job on. But the expectations have been so high in terms of the growth of the market that the companies themselves have been largely guilty of putting out pro forma numbers, so projected revenue numbers, projected profitability numbers over the next couple of years that were supposed to, let's stay in the Canadian kind of metaphor, they were supposed to hockey stick in a way that there's just no way they were going to do this.
Right.
And therefore, what we've seen over the last 3 to 6 months is a series of you know, call it the over the last couple quarters of earnings results.
Periods, that, we call that, it, not quarters, periods, hockey. Go ahead.
Perfect. A couple of earnings periods where we've actually seen the companies themselves not only guide lower, but show that the expectations in terms of their pro forma were totally unrealistic. When you layer in the fact that a lot of these companies took the currency of their stock prices to make acquisitions, and a lot of the acquisitions were in assets that frankly in the early stages might have looked interesting when all the investment was going into, you know, building greenhouses, building cultivation in far-flung parts of Canada or even the United States, people are realizing that a lot of these assets need to get written down. And I think that's been the story over the last couple of quarters. So it's you know, the good news is that in the last 2 to 3 weeks, a number of the U.S. players and you know, there's a couple pretty decent Canadian earnings reports out in the last month or so as well. But Curaleaf, Cresco Labs, Trulieve, these are all companies that have shown that they've actually started to. You know, get somewhere along that hockey stick line.
Tilray as well?
No, I wouldn't put Tilray in that camp. And I think Tilray...
They're still on the bench.
Tilray should get some credit for putting together a company that was able to attract either JV interest or strategic interest from some of the biggest multinationals in the crossover industries that everybody knows are going to be a part of this sector. So whether it's a deal with ABI, Bud, whether it's a deal with Novartis, whether it's a deal with Authentic Brands, Tilray's been out there and I think has you know, packed a lot of momentum into their market cap for being seen not only as a early leader in the Canadian space, but by being a global company that was going to have this type of strategic multinational influence and distribution and
right.
quickly, you know, leapfrog. But the reality is that Tilray's not even, to me, a top five player in Canada. And Tilray is non-existent in the United States outside of some of the discussions and the JV, progress they've made with a number of these companies. The problem with Tilray is a poster child for everything that can go wrong for investors when
I thought CanTrust was.
Well, there's two different things here. So we'll talk about CanTrust as well. But to finish the point on Tilray is they were the first IPO on the NASDAQ. They were the first new money raised on a U.S. major stock exchange by a Canadian company. Because of that, there was a rush to market because of the liquidity dynamics of the U.S. exchanges, because of the premium that anything would trade on relative to a Canadian exchange, because of the NASDAQ effect, or later with Canopy and Aurora as they then issued and uplisted to the New York Stock Exchange. Those are reasons why those premiums existed. They don't explain the whole dynamic, but Tilray, as we know, had this blow off top that actually hit intraday, $300 a share, and is now, scraping to get, near $30 a share.
Wow.
Let's talk about CanTrust.
I want to talk about CanTrust, Tim, but we have to take a break. We're going to talk about CanTrust after the break. I also want to talk about the dark cloud on some of the companies in the U.S. because we don't want to just talk about Canada. We're talking to Tim Seymour from Fast Money. I'm Alan Gervie. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Well, actually, it's not clear if the glass is half full or half empty, depending on, what state of mind you're in, whether maybe you had a joint or not, or whether you're just clear thinking. I'm not going to go there. We've got so much to talk about. We've only got another 10 minutes. We're talking to Tim Seymour, who's CIO of Seymour Asset Management. And Tim, there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about, and I do want to talk about the Amplify Seymour Cannabis ETF in a couple minutes. Also, I want to talk about the M&A opportunities that you alluded to before the break. But before we get there, talk briefly about CanTrust and what can go wrong. And, we talk about regulations and we talk about the government looking over these companies. Well, sometimes these companies may not be as honest as they're supposed to be.
No, and I think this is what you see, again, in an emerging asset class with new companies. And when capital's falling from the sky, and investors are either less sophisticated or don't hold companies to the same standards they might in other places, I think you get an opportunity for companies to really run afoul. And corporate governance in a sector like this is obviously going to be critical. The irony is that I think a lot of companies in the space, before we dive into CanTrust problems and argument that they're not, have a lot of companies have grown up in an environment where compliance and the regulatory framework was critical to their survival, and they're adhering to following the rules. So I think there are great operators in the space. There are guys that I think are absolutely following toeing the line. But to give you some insight into CanTrust, so this is arguably one of the top four or five big LPs in Canada, who I guess they really started with at least the fall of this company in terms of the stock price and really in terms of the public eye started on kind of mid-July, early July, when they issued a statement related to an audit conducted by Health Canada. And as a result of that audit, Health Canada actually determined that they were non-compliant with a number of regulations. And from there, they had to suspend sale of all products. It began a greater review into the company, where it appeared that a number of their facilities were not only non-compliant in terms of following health standards, but in terms of truly, following the cultivation,
right,
kind of production guidelines they had told the market that they were following.
Basically, hiding their product.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're an investor in CanTrust, a couple quarters earlier, we were already starting to see some of the them just not able to execute on guidance. And they had, you know, a couple pretty catastrophic earnings results in the preceding couple periods where you can actually see that the stock began to leg down. So you're starting to get some sense of where things were, you know, also just from an operational perspective, not following up. The bad news on CanTrust certainly has dented investors' confidence. And I think, you know, the you add that to some other governance things that have come out, whether they be even Curaleaf getting dinged by the FDA for some of their products on the shelves and not adhering to some of the, you know, the recent FDA guidelines on CBD. You throw in some of the news out of some of the Canadian assets that we talked about that were getting marked down because the prices were just not justified to the valuations that they'd been quoted. Bruce Linton at Canopy Growth, who was seen as an industry kind of pioneer and visionary, was fired, and the sense was, is there a smoking gun there? I don't think that is the case, by the way. And if anything, I would say what's happened at Canopy Growth in terms of a management change is more indicative of an industry that needs to grow up and that needs to get more sophisticated, and that, you know, the bar has been not only raised in terms of the strategic partners and the investors, and in Canopy Growth's case, they have, you know, arguably one of the biggest, most sophisticated consumer products companies in the world in Constellation Brands as a strategic partner and core investor. But you know, you're seeing institutional presence in the market that is demanding a higher standard. And I think ultimately that's good for investors. I think what you often see in an asset class like this is that the early wave of a lot of investors tends to be family offices, private banks, high net worths. And it doesn't, I don't mean to draw the conclusion that these investors aren't sophisticated, but I think sometimes the processes and the due diligence approach is a little bit different.
Tim, if they're not pursuing M&A opportunities, is that going to really be a blemish on these companies, especially some of the larger ones like you're talking about, like Canopy and Aurora?
If they're not pursuing an M&A?
Right. I mean, is that going to be the key to the future in terms of the growth and
the key to the future is execution. The key is who are the best operators. The key is who are the companies that are going to be profitable. The market is demanding profitability right now. And that's why I say when I look at least the earnings results out of Cresco Labs, who showed, you know, a little over $3 million in EBITDA for the quarter on a gross margin in the 40s. You know, that's what the market wants to see. Curaleaf, again, they, you know, this is a company that I think is, there have been some questions about their business model, whether you want to have a full national footprint. They've certainly gone out there and been very aggressive in the kind of the wellness stylings of the industry. But, you know, it's great to see companies actually deliver at a time when they're supposed to be showing profitability.
And where there are obstacles to the delivery. We only have a couple more minutes, and I want to ask you about the Amplify Seymour Cannabis ETF. Tell us about that, how you're looking at the stocks. There's right now, what, 25 to 30 stocks in the portfolio?
Yeah, there's 32 stocks in the portfolio. And so this is an ETF for investors that really want an actively managed product in an industry that's changing by the day. And so, you know, our goal is to not necessarily be overly tactical on a day-to-day basis. Our goal is to know what we own, to have met with every company in the portfolio, is to understand whether we're investing in the right part of the industries of the industry, the right subsectors of the industry now and, you know, and tomorrow when those will continue to change. The key to one of the dynamics we have to face is similar to what some of the companies are going through. We're only able to invest in those companies that we are legally able to invest in an SEC-governed 40 Act product in the United States, which means that we can't own a lot of the U.S. multi-state operators who are operating right now in a federally not illicit environment. Let's just put it that way. It is an illicit environment. And so one of the challenges I have as a portfolio manager is finding companies that I think are well positioned in either those markets in the U.S. where they can trade, whether it's a Charlotte's Web, who's a CBD player that's operating legally and one of the largest market cap plays in that space.
You know, I don't want to interrupt him, but we've got a minute or two, and I just want to get a couple of real important questions. First of all, how do people invest in something like the Amplify Seymour Cannabis ETF?
So the ticker is CNBS, like you might abbreviate the word cannabis. And my guess is anyone who has an online account with one of the big players in that space can log on and buy this ETF, or they could talk to their financial advisor and say, okay, this is an ETF I want to own. Okay. Investing thematically in this sector right now, to me, for the investor that can't do the kind of work that's required on a daily basis, is the way to invest. And I think a diversified approach by an active manager who spends
a lot of time,
whole days in the sector, that's
makes a lot of sense. Last question, we only have a minute. I'm getting texts and phone calls from Tim Seymour. What cannabis stocks, if you're only going to invest in two or three, what are the ones to invest in as it exists right now?
Tough question, just because I think there's some limitations to the businesses of all of them. But how about just some names that we've mentioned right here? I think what you saw in Cresco Labs' report about 10 days ago is this is a company that's proven they can be profitable in the United States. It's a company that they are growing in a core market. Look, Illinois is going to be a $2 billion market in the near future and really goes fully online in 4 months. They're showing that they're a leader in that market now. I like the management team. I think they've made some strong acquisitions. Look, I'm going to go back to Canopy Growth on this one. And this is maybe more controversial now after they've dropped a donut or two out there. I think a company that's got $3.1 billion in cash on their balance sheet with, as I said, one of the most sophisticated big brothers, quote unquote, in any consumer products business, especially one that's really built on branding and distribution, is a company I want to own at a time when I think the sector is going to continue to consolidate. I think they've
had some operational issues. And you still think it's priced right? You don't think it's overvalued?
I think the earnings valuation is not something I would pound the table on. I think the strategic positioning of this company as a global player with that combination of partners right now is still puts them one plus one equals three plus.
Right.
In a world where I think a lot of deals came together where companies, everybody thought one plus one equaled three. I think the combination of these resources and that balance sheet and that distribution and that global network is powerful.
Perfect. All right. Well, we're going to have to cut it there. Tim Seymour from Seymour Asset Management, thanks so much for being with us and all your insight in the cannabis investment world today.
Thanks, Alan. Great to be here.
All right. Take it easy. All right. That's going to do it for our show. You've just been listening to Gervie's Law. We'll be here next week. And thanks again. We'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.